Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Bells of Oceania by Arthur J. Burks. It was on a heavily laden troop ship, westward heading, hours before the sun had gone down toward China, trailing ebon night behind her. For a full week since dropping the California coast behind us, there had been nothing in all the wild waste of waters for us to see save ourselves. No ship's funnels broke the lowering horizon, no sign of land, for our skipper had chosen a passage lying somewhere in between the usual steamer lanes. The nearest land, save that which stretched in eternal darkness some 3 miles below us, was more than 1,000 miles beyond the southern horizon. We were just a single ship, burdened with a precious freight of souls, upon an ocean that seemed endless. The first day out had been squally and everyone had been sick, save those of us who had gone down to the sea in ships before. But with the dawning of the second morning, the sea had calmed down and our vessel rode through the blue, toward the horizon bowl which ever crept before us, in the golden wake of the setting sun. The voyage, if the old salt spoke truly, would be uneventful, but with that strange premonitory feeling which comes to all of us at times, I did not believe them. Something, from the very first, warned me that our voyage was ill-fated. I couldn't explain my feeling. It wasn't a feeling of dread exactly, nor of fear, just a strange feeling of unease, much like that which comes to people on their first voyage, when a ship is rolling slightly under their feet, and everything, until they get their sea legs, seems strangely out of focus. That doesn't explain it, I know, but it is as near as I can put my feeling into words. I knew, when the sun went down ahead of us, with 180th meridian less than 24 hours ahead, that we were on the eve of strange, momentous happenings. To add to my feeling of unease, and as though it had all been planned out by some invisible something or somebody, in the vague beginning, the officer who should have been the watch that night fell suddenly ill, and I was called upon to take his place. I knew, as I donned my belt, holster, and pistol, that I obeyed the will of some invisible prompter, a prompter without a name. We had 7 sentries out at various important places about the ship, and I made the routine inspections before turning in, less than an hour before midnight. When I entered my stateroom and turned on the light, that feeling of unease was more pronounced than it had been at any time previously. I had the feeling, though I had locked my door when I had last quitted my stateroom, that I had entered again immediately after someone had left it. Yet that was impossible. I had carried the key in my pocket all the time, and my cabin boy was not provided with one. There was no way that anyone, or anything, could have entered my stateroom in my absence, save, still, as though my every move had been ordered by some invisible prompter, my eyes darted to the porthole beside my bed. It was quite too small for the passage of a human body. If anyone had gone out through the porthole, that one had fallen or plunged into the sea, for had the porthole been ever so big, there was absolutely no way one could have left my stateroom by that way and still remained upon the ship, unless that one had gone out and were even now hanging by his hands along the ship's side. So strongly had the feeling of an alien presence intruded itself upon me that in spite of knowing myself an utter fool for entertaining any doubt whatsoever, I strode to the porthole and looked out. There was nothing, of course, save water, now black and forbidding, stretching away to the south, to a horizon that, since night had fallen, seemed to have crept quite close to us to watch our passing. Still unsatisfied, in spite of arguing with myself, condemning myself for a fool, I deliberately closed the glass, which masked the port, took my seat in a chair beside the bunk, facing the round glass, which resembled, to an imagination suddenly fevered, the eye of a huge one-eyed giant of the porthole, and began to undress. Mechanically, I lifted first one foot, then the other, removing shoes and stockings, but I kept my eyes upon the closed porthole, and that feeling of an unseen presence in the room was stronger as the moments fled. My undressing completed, I stood erect to turn out the lights and paused in the very act. A cry of terror smothered in my throat by a sheer act of will. For the most fleeting of seconds, I had seen a dead white face outside the glass, which covered the porthole. It was the face of a person who had drowned. I told myself wildly, and the dripping hair wore a coronet of fluttering seaweed. The eyes of the stranger outsider stared straight into mine, devoid of expression, totally unwinking, and the lips, which seemed blue as though with icy cold long endured, smiled a thin and ironic smile. It took all the courage I possess, which is little enough in the face of the unknown, to hurl myself across the bed, right hand extended toward the heavy screw which held a circular piece of glass in place. In the instant my hand would have touched the glass, the ship rode into the edge of the storm that was to fill the remainder of the night, and the stern of the steamer rose dizzily on the crest of a mighty wave, dragging all the vessel with it, and the face slid slowly out of sight, below the porthole, the bluish lips still smiling. I admit that I was trembling, that my fingers were unsteady as I fumbled with the screw to unloose the glass. When the porthole was open once more, and the cold breeze of this latitude came in to fan my fevered face, I thrust my head out of the port and gazed right and left and up and down along the curving side of the ship. But there was nothing save straight ahead on our port side, and even there was nothing but black water, huge mountainous waves touched with white caps at their crest like flying shrouds or like lacy streamers created as a fringe for the mantle of night. I watched several of the waves sweep under the vessel, which rose and fell sluggishly. The waves seemed to be traveling in no certain direction, but broke into a veritable welter of warring forces, roaring as they came together with a bellowing of maddened, deep-throated bulls. Valleys with darkness on their floors, mountain tops touched with snow that shifted eerily in the breeze. I was about to close the port when, many yards away from the ship, as though born of the womb of old ocean, I heard the bells. Like the tiny bells which the bellwethers wear to signal the ewes and the lambs, was the tinkling of the bells, like those bells, yet not like them, totally out of place in mid-ocean, and I felt a strange prickling of the scalp as I listened. Hurriedly driven by a fear I could not have explained then, nor can I now explain, I closed the porthole again and whirled about with another scream, which this time came forth from my quivering lips in spite of all I could do to prevent. Just inside my stateroom door stood my sergeant of the guard, and his lips were trembling more wildly than my own, his eyes protruding horribly. His face was chalk white, and he was striving with all his power to speak. As I watched his manful struggle, I dreaded for him to speak, for I knew that what he had come to tell me would be something strange and terrible, something hitherto entirely outside my experience. "Sir," he managed at last, when I stifled not a permission for him to speak, "I must make the rounds of the sentries." Here the poor fellow stopped, unable to go on, and his knees knocked together audibly. "Yes, Sergeant," I managed to mutter. "You went the usual rounds of the sentries, and then?" "The sentry who should be on duty on the main deck forward of the bridge is missing." Of course, I knew on the instant that there might be many reasons for the failure of the sergeant of the guard to find the sentry, many logical reasons. The sentry might have quitted the post, a violation of regulations, true, for a quiet cigarette in the lee of a lifeboat. He might have been walking his post in the direction taken by the sergeant, so that the latter had not overtaken him, even with a complete circling of the main deck. He might, or, there were many logical explanations, but I guessed instinctively that none of these reasons fitted the case. For one thing, the sergeant of the guard was an old-timer, had spent many years of his life at sea. Yet, he was frightened half out of his wits, and I knew he held as many decorations for bravery as any other officer or man in the Marine Corps. There was something terrible, something, if you will, uncanny behind this disappearance of the sentry. I muttered an oath, more to prod my own flogging courage than for any other reason, and started toward the door, motioning the sergeant to precede me. But he shook his head stubbornly and barred my way. I halted, for it was evident that he had not completed his report. "You'll maybe think me daft," he said, "but I couldn't let you go out there, sir, without telling you everything. The corporal on watch at the head of the promenade gangway told me a strange story just before I made my rounds. He opened the door leading onto the starboard promenade for a look at the weather outside, and just as he was about to close it again, the ship lifted on the crest of a huge wave, and out beyond the wave, many yards away from the ship, he heard something which he likened to the tinkling of little bells." "Good God," I exclaimed. And the sergeant continued, "all the time I was looking for the missing sentry, I had the idea there was someone behind me, following me every step of the way. Yet when I whirled to look, the deck behind me was empty." "And you found no sign of the sentry?" I said stupidly. The sergeant shook his head. "Nothing," he said, except, well, sir, you'll maybe think me daft, as I said before, but on the spot where the sentry had stood to wait for me on my last round, I found wet marks on the deck floor, the marks as near as I could tell with my flashlight, of bare feet." Mechanically, as the sergeant spoke, I had been donning my clothes, leaving my shoes, however, unlaced. I felt an icy chill along my spine as the sergeant continued, and I dreaded, as I had never dreaded anything before, to ask him further about those wet footprints on the deck. "The wet footprints," he went on, and he was talking wildly now, his words tripping over one another. So rapidly were they uttered, as though he wished to finish his report before I could interrupt again. "Led away where the sentry should have been standing, straight to the starboard rail. Right at the rail, I stooped to examine the prints more closely. They were the footprints of a human being, I was sure, and the marks of the toes were blurred and very wide, as though whoever or whatever had made them had been carrying a burden in his arms." "Good God, sergeant," I said again, "what are you driving at?" "Just this, sir. There's something terribly wrong with his ship. Something took that sentry bodily over the side." I believe that putting a name, however meaningless, to what was in my own mind caused a little of my courage to return, for I did not find it difficult now to bring myself to leave the stateroom. The sergeant almost trod on my heels as I hurried to the main deck, starboard side, where the wind wrapped icy fingers round me, chilling me to the bone. As I hurried forward, I looked over the water into the welter water and stopped short. Behind me, the sergeant groaned, hollowly, like a man who had been mortally wounded, for out of the waters, away to starboard, came the sound of tinkling bells. I darted to the rail and leaned far outboard, striving to pierce the gloom. There was nothing save the watery wastes, mountains and valleys, and two spots of greenish phosphorescence, far out like serpent's eyes, which watched the passing ship. When I looked at them closely, straining my eyes, seeking the form below the eyes, the twin balls of eerie flame vanished, a wall of water protruding between itself. Well, we found the sentry, sprawled on his face, where the sergeant should have found him on his rounds. I turned the body over, and it was quite cold, with excellent reason. The corpse was dripping wet, entirely nude, and the lips and cheeks as coldly blue as though the corpse had been dragged for hours on a line in the wake of the ship. No matter how secluded one's life may have been, no matter how carefully one may have been guarded during one's lifetime, there come into the lives of most of us certain inexplicable happenings which may never be forgotten. This matter of the dead sentry was one of these for me, and I shall go to my grave with the memory of his cold cheeks and bluish lips limned upon the retina of my very soul. So many strange circumstances. Thank God that at that moment I could not look into the 2 hours or more of terror which even then stretched before me, else I should most surely have gone entirely mad. Were there connected with this matter that, taken altogether, it is little wonder that I have been unable to forget. The roaring of the wind, which was lashing all the ocean into fury, a maelstrom in mid-ocean, ghostly white caps stretching away into darkness, into seeming infinity, the frightened sergeant behind me, his teeth chattering with fear, the dead sentry at my feet, his body blue with cold, entirely nude, as I have said, the marks on the deck of huge bare feet, wet as though the feet had come up out of the sea, the eerie sound of bells between our vessel and the lowering horizon, and that dead white face which I had seen beyond the porthole of my own cabin a half hour before. What was the explanation of it all? What was the cause of the bells, if bells there were? What had come up out of the sea to stride barefooted across the promenade deck of the slumbering troop ship? Had my sentry seen whatever had come for him before he had been taken? Add to all these circumstances the fact that all hell was loose in the watery waste, that it was now after midnight, and you will understand a little of my feelings. Never before or since have I been as frightened as I was then. I don't regard myself as a coward, nor am I ordinarily superstitious, but show me the man who is without fear in the presence of the unknown, the utterly uncanny, and I will show you a man who has no soul. I whirled, bumping into the sergeant, who manfully muffled a scream at my unexpected movement, and started almost blindly toward the stern of the troop ship. As I strode along, with the sergeant at my heels, once more strange images fled across my mind. I remembered the tale of D. Lorelei, the maiden who had lured sailors to their death with her eerie singing, and strained my eyes through the gloom, seeking shapes I feared to see. Then my mind went further back, to the years before I could read, years in which, thirsty for knowledge, I studied pictures out of old histories to satisfy my longing for wisdom. One of these pictures came back to my mind as I hurried aft, a picture of a hideous monster of unbelievable proportions, who had come up from behind the ocean's horizon, blotting out the sunlight, long arms extended into the picture's foreground, the right hand holding aloft a medieval sailing vessel, which had been lifted bodily from the ocean. A fantastic picture, I knew now, drawn to prove the existence of terrible monsters beyond the horizon to which as yet no caravel or galleon had dared travel. I wondered as I strode aft why this old picture should return to my mind at this time, and fear was at my throat again as I walked. I am coming, O my beloved. The words, high-pitched with ecstasy, came from straight ahead of me, and out of the heavy shadow, cast by a huge funnel, stepped one of my sentries. Just for a second, as he strode toward the starboard rail, I could see his face, and the face was transfigured, as though the man gazed into the very soul of the perfect sweetheart somewhere beyond the rail. Slowly, step by step, as though he would prolong the joy of anticipation, the sentry who had hurled his rifle aside approached the rail, still with his eyes fixed on the welter of waters overside. Why, I halted spellbound to watch what he would do. From out of the waters there came once more the tinkling of bells, and with a sound as though the sound had been a signal, a huge shadow detached itself from the shadow whence the sentry had stepped but a moment ago, and loomed high above the luckless youth. At the same time the ship climbed high above a monster wave, so that her starboard side went down, down, until white water came over the side, and when she straightened again, shuddering through all of her, the sentry had vanished. From well rearward of where the man had disappeared, from out of the smothers of water, there came a single long-drawn cry. And it was not a cry of terror, not a cry of pain, but a scream of ecstasy. "He's gone, sergeant," I said stupidly. "But what took him? Not the wave. He had only to seize the rail to save himself." "Did you see the shadow, lieutenant?" the sergeant replied. I did not answer. He knew I had seen it. We strode on again, heading towards the stern. And all about us now, over the ship, on either side of her, but never on her, there tinkled the eerie, unexplainable bells. We stood at last in the very stern of the troop ship, gazing into the ghostly wake far below our coign of vantage, and with certain care I followed the wake rearward with my eyes. But one could not follow it afar. That was a circumstance which impressed itself upon me almost at once. The wake died away, short off, within less than a dozen yards of the ship's stern, as at the very moment of birth it had been ignominiously smothered. In a trice I understood the reason, and thought I understood many things besides, for like a monster raft stretching away rearward as far as I could see, and into the darkness beyond my vision to right and left, there followed us, close to it, an undulating mass of odorless seaweed. Acres and acres of it there were, rising and falling sluggishly, but keeping pace with the troop ship through the night and the storm. Came again that sound of bells, and my hair stiffened at the base of my skull when I saw watching the seaweed the result of the tinkling of the bells. The seaweed, when the bell sounded, seemed imbued suddenly with life that was utterly and completely rampant. Long tendrils of the stuff drew away to right and left below us, as though endowed with will of their own, and these tendrils, countless thousands of them, collided with other tendrils in the mass, and slithered over them so that all the mass of the seaweed writhed as though in torment, resembling countless hordes of serpents gathered together from all the evil places of the earth. And where the tendrils had drawn aside, I could see black water in the rift as though the tendrils had drawn aside so that I might see. Some terrible fascination held me, my eyes fixed on that space of black water. For several moments, after the tendrils of the seaweeds had drawn away to right and left, and up from the depths into the opening, came two who filled all my being with abject terror and something else. One of the two was dead, I knew on the instant, for I could see his face, all white and drawn, yet with the blue lips smiling, of the ill-fated sentry who had gone over the side before my very eyes, and he had been brought up from the depths in the arms of, I hesitate to give the creature a name, a woman, I scarcely know, yet this I do know. In the instant I looked into her eyes, I understood the ecstasy I had read in the face of the sentry whom she now held in her arms. Her breast nude and unashamed were the breast of a buxom woman, her lips as red as full-blown roses, her hair as black as the wings of a crow, a mantle of loveliness all about her wondrous body, whipping this way and that in the storm. Her eyes swerved away from mine, and one arm, shapely and snowy, raised aloft from the water, and to my ears came again the sound of tinkling bells. Once more the seaweed writhed and twisted, pressed forward about the ship, but a single mass of it detached itself from the larger mass, pressed close to the, should I call her woman, and swerved away again, and the arms of the beautiful creature were empty. Instinctively I whirled about, knowing somehow that I must move my head before I met this creature's eyes again, and stared forward to the shadowy portion of the promenade whence the sentry had emerged before his plunge over the side. Up the starboard side of the ship crept a veritable wall of seaweed, up to the rail, pausing there for a moment, then to the deck, where it squirmed for a moment or two, taking a weird distorted shape that made me think of a man. From out of the heart of this monstrosity there dropped soggily a white cold figure. The second sentry had returned, as the first had done. I knew, as I searched through all my experience, seeking the key to this uncanny enigma, that we were heading westward outside the usually traveled sea lanes, that ships seldom, if ever, came this way, that in 7 days we had seen not one vessel, nor even the smoke of one upon the horizon. Why did not vessels come this way? But I could not answer my many questions. I could only ask them and hope within me that they be not answered ever. Nauseated by the return of the dead sentry, nude as the first had been, I closed my eyes for a moment, and when I opened them again, there was no seaweed, no monstrous shape upon the promenade, but even from where I stood I could see the wet footprints, and wondered whom next the creatures of the deep would claim from aboard our ill-fated vessel. I drew my pistol and returned once more towards the stern of the ship. This creature of the death, whatever it was, had taken life twice. Whatever it was mortal, and whatever is mortal, a bullet will slay. but in the very act of whirling, I stopped short, for between me and the stern of the vessel, smiling dreamily, water rippling over her nude and glorious body, to splash upon the deck, stood the creature who had come up from the depths in the wake of the ship, bearing the dead man in her arms. My arm fell to my side, my weapon clattered to the deck, and as I moved forward once more, slowly, a step at a time, as a sentry had done, the wondrous creature held out her dripping arms, and my eyes drank in all the glorious wonder of her, from head to, but she had no feet. Where the feet should have been, and the legs, there were neither legs nor feet, but a scaly column, wet and dripping, like a serpent, with a woman's body. I screamed in terror and unbelief, but it was too late, and her arms were about me, preventing all escape. But with the touch of those arms, I did not wish to struggle. I knew what had happened to the two sentries, knew the same was the prospect for me, yet at the moment there seemed nothing in all the world more worthwhile than to slip over the side into the depths with the arms of this wondrous creature about me. "Lieutenant! Lieutenant, for the love of God, what is happening to you?" It was the voice of the sergeant of the guard, frighted with abysmal terror, but I did not care. The shapely, strangely warm arms of the sea creature were about me, and the sound of the bells, unbelievably sweet now, was in my ears. For me the world had ceased to exist, save for knowledge that these two things were true. I was carried to the rail, and went over slowly, without commotion, as comfortably as though I had been riding on a couch of eiderdown, and came to myself to know myself lost indeed. I was deep down, whirling over and over, behind the whirling screws of the ship, holding my breath until my lungs were nigh to bursting, swimming with all my might, striving to reach the surface, and life-giving air, which I hadn't the slightest idea which way was upward. With all my power I fought toward the surface, but my progress was slow and dragging, for there was a weight about my knees, as though arms were clasped about them, striving to hold me down. A wordless voice was in my ears, begging, beseeching, and there was something in the voice which made my struggle seem foolish and unnecessary, so I desired never to reach the air I needed. I closed my eyes, which had opened instinctively upon striking the water, and two lips pressed firmly against my own, and those lips saved my life and my reason, for they were the cold lips of a corpse, with neither love nor challenge in them. I flailed out once more, and my hand caught in the line which the steamer dragged over her stern to measure the knots she traveled. All about me as I was hurled forward, now under water, now with nostrils out for a brief breathing space, the mass of seaweed rose and fell on the heavy seas. God knows how I ever got back aboard the troop ship, but I awoke at mess call in the morning and sent immediately for the sergeant of the guard. "What happened after I came back aboard last night, sergeant?" I asked abruptly. The sergeant of the guard stared at me as though he thought me insane. "I don't understand you," he managed finally. "Have we finally passed through the area of seaweed?" "Seaweed? Is a lieutenant making sport of me? We're 2,000 miles from any land. Save the ocean bottom, and there ain't any seaweed anywhere. I don't understand you." "Let it pass," I said. "When did you last visit the sentries last night?"
"Just before midnight, sir."
"And were all of them at their post of duty?"
"Yes, sir."
"And what about the bells?" Again, the sergeant's puzzlement was so genuine that I knew he did not understand my meaning. How much of my experience had been real, how much fantasy? I tried another tack. "Did you make a round of the sentries after midnight?" The sergeant shook his head sheepishly. "It is one of the rules of guard duty that one visits to all sentries must take place between midnight and morning." "Then the guard hasn't been mustered this morning. Is everyone present?" "You don't know? Then go at once and find out." 10 minutes later, the sergeant returned, chalk white of face, to report that two of the guards were missing and could not be found anywhere aboard. He told me their names, and instantly my mind went back to the night of uncanny happenings just past, and the two nude bodies brought back from the deep in the arms of whom or what. I never knew. And to this day the question I have propounded have never been answered. But this I know. There are strange things and sounds in the sea near the 180th meridian, 1,000 miles north of Honolulu, and this is the strangest incident in my night of terror. The clothing which I donned next morning was entirely dry, but my hair was stiff with salt water, and there was the tang of seaweed in my room when I awoke. I looked, too, at the glass which covered the porthole beside my bed. Outside that glass were the smudge prints of thin lips, the blur above them, which told of a face pressed against the glass from outside, as though somebody or something had tried to peer in between nightfall and morning. And the bells? I still can hear them in memory when sometimes I waken at sea after midnight, and the rolling and the plunging of the ship tell me that a storm is making.